Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really pleased to be joined for the second time this week by two faculty colleagues from Carthage College, both from the political science department, Jeffrey Roberg and Jerry Mast. And they were here on Monday to talk about where things stood or seemed to stand at that point on the eve of this momentously important presidential election. And now they are here a couple days thereafter to react to what in fact ensued. What seems, at least on the surface, to be maybe the most surprising presidential election results that I can remember in my lifetime. I think the closest being the defeat of Jimmy Carter seemed like it was a surprise, although I remember exit polls that pointed to maybe an unsuccessful outcome for President Carter. But aside from that, I can't think of another election that ended as surprisingly as this one did. Am I right about that?
I share that sentiment. It is very surprising. Your choice of 1980 is interesting because 1980 is an important election in terms of the structure of the electorate and voting behavior and the composition of the parties, in that it really does reflect the kind of the high watermark of a shift of blue-collar white voters towards the Republican Party, and you know, we'd call them Reagan Democrats, right? And they really served as a key component of his regime, his base or coalition. One of the things that we saw on Tuesday was a very solid base of support among white working class people for Mr. Trump. I think that the reasons why 1980 were surprising and the reasons why Tuesday was so surprising are somewhat different, but there are some connections there too.
What can we say about all of the polls that got this so wrong? Even before we start talking about, in a sense, why Mr. Trump defeated Mrs. Clinton, I think one of the most interesting questions is why all of these predictions were so askew. It's probably too early to really know the answer to that, but do you have any guesses or thoughts about that?
Well, it is a very complicated question. It's a really important one and a fascinating one. To have a real kind of concrete sense of what went wrong will require some research. So the methodologists in political science will be poring over that, and right. The statisticians will be looking into it. I can offer some kind of preliminary thoughts.
And just to clarify again, right now we're talking about how the polls went wrong. We're not talking about, for instance, what the Democrats did wrong or Mrs.
Right.
Clinton and her
Correct.
Staff went wrong. This
right,
is
right,
wrong
right.
in terms of the polls getting their predictions wrong.
Right. So the polling seems to have been off by, you know, 3 or 4 points on average, and that's a pretty sizable miss. It's not kind of out of keeping with some recent misses as well, and so we've now had a number of misses of this proportion that we can, you know, start to say, hey, wait a minute. My preliminary kind of suspicion about why some of this was wrong, let me kind of offer a little bit of characterization of the way that all of this polling works. So surveys involve asking some random sample of the population who you intend to vote for, right? And to the extent that the objective of the pollsters is to be predictive, to try to understand who is likely to win the election, or if we were to hold the election right away, what you're trying to get at is who is going to show up and vote, right? And so you're modeling the electorate to a certain extent. Every random sample is going to have some error in it in terms of who shows up. a perfect sample is one that resembles your population in all the important ways. But when you randomly select some a sample, and by that you're trying to give every individual in the population an equal chance of inclusion into the sample, you're still going to end up, just through random chance, with a sample that's slightly different from the population, right? And so because it's slightly different from the population, the results that you get from that sample, you're going to make some mistakes when you're inferring something about the population. Mm. So there's something wrong with the sampling. There's some sampling error going on there. And you can try to account for that by making adjustments. You say, wow, my sample's a little bit off. And so I'm gonna make some corrections to it. You can weight some of the members of your sample a little more heavily than others. And once you do that, there's another step, and that is to create a likely voter model. The likely voter model is a kind of a screen. You're gonna try to filter out the people in your sample who you don't think are going to vote. Either they tell you they're not going to vote, or they say, yeah, I might vote, and then you have to kind of make a judgment about what does that mean, right? Mm. They will or they won't. So you create this screen. It's a likely voter model. And when statisticians and pollsters are trying to make correct for sampling error, how are they doing that? Well, they're looking at previous electorates. How are they building their likely voter models? Well, they're looking at what we know about voter behavior, right? And the electorate in 2008 was a little bit different from the electorate in 2012, and the electorate in 2016 is different from the electorate in 2012. Not radically different, right? I mean, they're very, very similar. But if, to the extent that they're a little bit different, right, we get change from election cycle to election cycle, the modeling, the predictions, right, will be off in a little bit. And the mechanism by which these electorates change, right, is that likely, some likely voters actually don't vote, and some unlikely voters, in fact, do. And so the patterns of assumptions that modelers and pollsters are making about the electorate are not just random guesses. They're intelligent, informed guesses about how things are going to go. And sometimes you're going to be wrong.
Evidently. Well, and it sounds like in this particular case, they were perhaps making maybe a series of assumptions,
right,
about a certain swath of the population that...
Well, now let's also give them some credit, right? They were wrong, but they were still within 3 or 4 percentage points, and being off a little bit can sometimes have very big effects, right? And so we see really big effects in the Electoral College. I mean, they predicted the population vote winner correctly in the sense that Ms. Clinton did win the popular vote by. At this point, it's like 250,000 votes.
Hmm. Yeah, you've got right margin of error in terms of the poll itself, and the assumptions that are worked in, they're based on a variety of aspects of what we can expect of who's going to show up and what the polls don't take into effect depending upon when they're done. Is current events, shall we say. So when we were on the show on Monday, I believe it was, we talked about the FBI investigation. And that clearly shows up in terms of the Comey effect, so to speak, on when voters decided. What we know from Election Day is, you know, when in the exit polls, 8% of the folks who answered that they decided in the last few days, 44% voted for Clinton, 46% for Trump. But if you go back a touch more than that, the 6% that had, you know, decided who they were going to vote for in the week prior, 38% went Clinton, 50% for Trump. And in October, 12% of the voters say they made up their mind in October. 37% of those went for Clinton, and 51% went for Trump. So here's a case that's not quite clear-cut, but where you've got, you know, events that are happening within the campaign that may affect aspects of how folks are going to vote, and that may or may not be captured by the the various survey models that are being used, because some folks may be thinking, well, I'm not going to vote, or some folks are going to be thinking, I am going to vote, but then don't vote in the end.
Hmm. What's interesting about those numbers, if I heard them correctly, it's way back, it was Clinton here, Trump here, and then it went this way.
Actually, the other way.
Oh, the other way. I heard you wrong.
Most recently, the in the last few days before the election, so the Comey investigation is over, right? You've got, it's a 44% for Clinton, 46% for Trump. So almost even break there.
Right. And then the earliest number you gave was?
The earliest number was, so in October, voters went 37% for Clinton and 51% for Trump.
So, I guess what we're missing here, though, is what is the share of the overall electorate? Those could be quite small shares. Most people have made their minds up well in advance.
Well, it comes out to about 26% from October to current, is at least in the exit polls.
Is that how it worked?
Yeah. So what that tells me, at least, is, you know, it confirms on some aspect that those folks who made their decisions earlier were leaning towards Clinton, okay? So first of all, not in October, but prior to October. And what's important about that is think about when the debates were. Mm. In the data that seems to suggest that Secretary Clinton won the debates, but the debates were so far away from Election Day.
Unlike 1980.
Yeah, that they didn't matter as much. And because you then had the FBI investigation reopen, that kind of, if I can phrase it this way, trumped the debates.
Hmm. That in people's minds, yes. In many people's minds. What about another factor that I think I suspect weighed very strongly, namely the announcement that rates for Obamacare were ratcheting drastically up, and also that, you know, certain carriers were pulling out of the program altogether. How much does that seem to figure into the exit polls in terms of being a reason people cited for going against Clinton and for Mr. Trump?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm
just trying to find that. Actually,
it felt like the worst possible timing for that to have been announced or to have come to light when it did. I mean, it feels like something that probably did some damage.
Could be. From my perspective, the issue of healthcare and policy implications of the election are one of the more interesting questions out there. And will they repeal Obamacare? Republicans have been saying they want to for 6 years now. Mr. Trump has said that he intends to do it. How is that going to work? Millions of people are going to lose their health insurance. People who have diabetes and asthma and emphysema and have, you know, worked with cancer can be denied health care now. They'll be able to be dropped from their insurance carriers when they reach some kind of cap. Are people thinking that through? There's real problems with Obamacare. You mentioned the impact on the cost of premiums being one of them, but repealing it. Now they talk about replacing it. Replacing it with what? that's really unclear. So from a policy scholarship perspective, this election was a horrible, horrible one in terms of its shedding any kind of light on the specific policy positions that the electoral choices represent. One of the bigger questions I have, on a grander scale, is how are we going to come to perceive this election in terms of its meaning? Right? What does it mean?
Right. Is there a mandate from who for what?
And the bottom line is that this election, like all elections, but boy, this one in particular, are going to mean a lot of things, many different things, and some of those things will be clearer than others. Some of those meanings will have solid support to kind of rationally justify that particular meaning. But many of the other meanings will be contestable, will be the subjective in the sense that we are going to have to kind of construct those meanings. Those are some really important questions floating out there. Not all of them are related to kind of the policy consequences of this election, but some of them most certainly are. Mm.
The electorate is split exactly as Jerry has said here, and with Obamacare, what we see in the exit polls is again it's resounding in this split. And what I mean by that is, so for those folks who thought that Obamacare did not go far enough or was about right, I mean that's 47% of the electorate. For those that thought it went too far, or 48% electorate. For those who went too far, it was 47% of the electorate.
Mm.
And you've got people on, you know, voting on both sides. So some who thought that it didn't go far enough, you know, 18% of those folks voted for Trump. We're going to have years of trying to decipher what this means, and obviously more immediately, right? The claim, Representative Ryan was gave a press conference yesterday and said that, you know, Trump has a mandate.
It's just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous.
It depends how we want to define this. And so I think back to the 1994 Republican Revolution, as it was so called. And the Republicans, of course, had taken over the House of Representatives and claimed that they had this mandate with about a fifth of the votes of the voting populace that year when you look at who voted. You may recall, right, they had a contract with America for, you know, what they were going to do in the first 100 days or so. And they had all this pushback from the general populace. And they said, you know, well, we didn't vote for this. And they were right because people didn't turn out and vote, right?
Mm.
But nonetheless, this is, I think, an analogous situation in terms of, you know, how President-elect Trump and the Republicans' majority at this point in time interpret these results will be quite interesting. Do they really believe that they can just – I mean, they have the power, right, to go ahead and put into effect what they want. The question is this what the electorate was saying?
Hmm.
And so,
well, not a majority of them.
So it'll be very interesting to see how they go forward.
Yeah. You know, I think we need to really kind of dive into this question a little bit further. Yesterday, I had a couple sections of American government, and I had conversations with my students about what the election might mean, and we walked our way through categories of policies that Mr. Trump has talked about. So, you know, he's talked about putting a ban on Muslims immigrating into the country. And he's, you know, modified that. So it's not focusing on Muslims. He talks about countries where terrorism is a concern. And I think we all know what that means. That's kind of a nudge, wink, wink kind of statement. He's talked about more aggressive policing in African-American communities. He's talked about the deportation of illegal immigrants. We're talking millions of people, most of whom, you know, have jobs and homes and are members of their communities. Many, many of them have children born in this country, which the 14th Amendment makes U.S. citizens. Are we going to go door to door in his predominantly Hispanic communities and demand documentation and arrest those who can't produce it? Are we going to deport American citizens? So we're talking about some of these issues. Are we going to engage in surveillance on mosques? I mean, he talked about that. Are we going to torture the families of terror suspects? And as I'm walking through some of these positions, my students who were very engaged in conversation, they really wanted to have this conversation. This is the first election, first presidential election in which they participated in. I had a number of students who were supporters of Trump. And to a person, they didn't like sit back and be quiet. To a person, they said, you know, we really regret some of the things he said in terms of the rhetoric. We feel uncomfortable about the divisiveness and the abrasiveness with which he spoke about people. We voted for him despite that, not because of it. And when it comes to you know, Obamacare or illegal immigration or you know, relating to Muslim Americans, they all said, well, we expect him to compromise, to shift to the middle and find, you know, ways to get at some of those problems that are legitimate without, you know, some of the negative consequences that are implied by these statements or these positions. So, you know, we can debate back and forth about whether or not those students are being realistic about what we can expect from a Trump administration, or whether they're being naive about it. But I raise this point to illustrate the intentions of their vote, what was motivating their vote. And so this idea that Speaker Ryan is trying to create, that there is somehow some mandate behind what Trump has been talking about is patently false. There's just no evidence to back it up. It is not a rational position to take, because one, more Americans voted for Hillary Clinton, and two, the Americans who chose to vote for Donald Trump voted for Donald Trump for many different reasons, for many different motivations, some of which were full-on support for Mr. Trump and the very specific things he said and the implications of the policy positions he's taken be damned. And many of them voted for him for much more, we might say, more benevolent kinds of reasons.
Right. In other words, it is not right to say that everyone who voted for Donald Trump wants him to build a wall. For instance,
correct.
Just to list very one correct. Component among, you know, many things that he has said, which is not to say he will or won't build a wall right. or attempt to do so. But yes, there are complicated reasons behind why people voted for Mr. Trump, and it appears that just frustration with the system was at the heart
one.
of a big part of it.
To your point about the wall, right? So 54% of the voters on Tuesday actually oppose the wall, yet 17% of these people voted for Trump.
Right. So where's your mandate?
And so you get, and your listeners have certainly, you know, read this or heard this in a number of cases, maybe even said this themselves, right? I don't think he really meant it, whatever was, right? And Jerry's right. We've got so many cross currents on this election that it's, you know, you take the candidate that you believe, you know, or leans your way on one thing, and you say, well, okay, is that more important to me than on something else, right? Mm. And that clearly shows up in what the voters did this most recent time. And you know, and if you look at what voters said was the most important quality for them of, you know, the candidate, or the most important foreign policy aspect, I mean, again, we get these cross currents. So even though Trump is supposed to be the economy guy, for those folks that said that the most important issue facing the country was the economy, the advantage went to Clinton on voting as opposed to Trump. For those who said immigration was most important or terrorism, that went to Trump. You know, in terms of qualities of leadership, those who believe that, you know, we need to, you know, bring needed change, then, you know, that went for Trump. Whereas, interestingly enough, cares about me, right experience, good judgment, all went Clinton in the scheme of things. So it's a very complicated electorate this time around.
For those of you just joining us, we are speaking today with Jerry Mast and Jeff Roberg, who are both political science professors at Carthage College. Let's untie for just a moment sort of what was behind Mr. Trump's victory and Mrs. Clinton's defeat. And we can, of course, apply this in a couple of different ways. We've already talked about the polls getting it wrong and some idea about why they got it wrong to the extent that they got it wrong. Clearly, some kind of mistake was made. I think it's clear to say that some kind of mistake was made in terms of Democratic strategy, that perhaps they made certain assumptions about certain components of the electorate that were in the bag, that obviously weren't in the bag, that actually defected across the aisle. I mean, case in point, for instance, Kenosha and Racine counties both going for Trump rather than for Mrs. Clinton, who never campaigned here personally. Can we talk about that sort of coalition, a different coalition from the traditional coalition, and to what extent that was a strategic error on the part of the Democrats, or was it not a concerted strategy? It's just sort of the reality that emerged.
Well, one of the things that I think best explains why Ms. Clinton didn't win is her failure to rally more white women to her side. And, you know, from where I stand, it's hard to blame them for not expecting something different. I certainly expected something different. But women overall, 54% of them went to Hillary Clinton, and 42% of them went to Trump. That represents a 1% improvement in performance for the Democrat relative to 2012. Mm. 1% of the women in the electorate shifted in favor of the Democrat going from 2012 to 2016. Despite the fact that Mr. Trump has said a number of things, right, that are you know, can be perceived as hostile or antagonistic about women. So the failure of the Clinton campaign to capture more women. The other that really stands out to me is Hispanics. 29% of them voted for Donald Trump, according to the exit polls.
Which is similar to Romney.
It's better than Romney, yeah. Right, by 8 percentage points.
Yep. Hmm.
By 8 percentage points. And so the talk about, you know, immigrants being rapists and murderers and so forth, and this talk about deporting people and building a wall and so on and so forth, he actually did better than Romney did when it comes to Hispanics. Now, more Hispanics turned out, and so the Democratic coalition you know, you could say it was a net improvement, but it wasn't nearly the kind of efficient improvement that they could very well understandably expect to happen.
What about the fact that the Democrats seem to have lost hold of lower and middle class whites that used to be very, very solidly in the Democratic camp?
Right.
When did that happen? How did that happen? And did that sort of, was there a drastic fall off this time around, or has this been a steady decline, and should all of us have seen this coming?
Oh, it's been a steady decline, I would say. I mean, it's a shift. It's a shift out of the what we would call the New Deal coalition, right? The New Deal coalition from the 1930s, in which Franklin Roosevelt assembled a very large group of people behind a larger federal government, more committed to regulation, more committed to creating a social safety net, and that coalition was composed of white liberals, predominantly in the North and the cities, African Americans for the first time coming to the Democratic Party from the Republican Party. It was composed of farmers who during the Great Depression were in serious trouble, and whites in the South. And the Democratic Party's base, right, regionally, you go back far enough, was in the South. It was the party of the solid South. And so the New Deal coalition kind of reflected a group of people committed to economic liberal policies to help out the working man, to help out poor people, to regulate the economy a little bit and create a social safety net. But it was also, to a large extent, pretty socially conservative. And so with time, in the 50s, the civil rights movement began to kick in. Many of those northern liberals began to align themselves with the civil rights movement, and many of the white Democrats in the South, of course, stood opposed to it. And by the time you get to the 1960s, the civil rights movement essentially forced the hand of the Kennedy administration and then the Johnson administration to get off the sidelines and take a real stand on civil rights, the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, kind of being the culmination of that. And that drove white conservatives out of the Democratic Party. And it didn't happen overnight, right? Hmm. I mean, it was an important factor in Nixon's election in 68. It kind of built up steam in the 70s. And it was integral to Ronald Reagan's massive electoral success. And so since then, right, blue-collar whites have been, a mix of conservative and liberal factors in the electorates of the country. But nonetheless, Democrats have been able to pull from blue-collar whites, with at least a degree of success to kind of make them important and effective players on the national stage. Bill Clinton did it very well in the 90s. Barack Obama less successfully, but he still drew from them. And Ms. Clinton did not.
I don't disagree with any of the discussion that Jerry had historically here. I think I do want to push back a little bit, and that is that Secretary Clinton didn't lose poor votes, so to speak. And that is that, 36% of the electorate that makes $50,000 or less went for Secretary Clinton in terms of by somewhere between 9 and 12 percentage points. Above 50,000, all those other groups above 50,000 break by 1 to 3%. Again, this is one of those – this electorate – is really complicated for us to kind of piece together. Again, Jerry's absolutely right in terms of the history of kind of how things have evolved with the Democratic Party. I'm not sure necessarily this election is telling us the end of that or the rest of that story there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't seem to me, and we've heard a lot of talk on news stations and whatnot about it, I'm not willing to just place this down as to a poor rural folks kind of sending a message. I don't think.
And you hear that rhetoric a lot.
I don't see that in at least the data that I'm looking at. That's not my interpretation as such. It is an interpretation. It is a part of our explanation. But if we're distilling it to this, I think we're doing ourselves a disservice.
Well, in the exit polls published on the New York Times, they report a shift of 16% towards Trump relative to 2012 in people who made less than $30,000 a year. Mm-hmm. I think that the relationship between income and vote choice still is one that in which Democrats can expect to win lower income folks, but that's when you count Hispanic low income folks and African American low income folks, and everybody, right? When you just looking at working class whites, there I think the loyalties are much more towards the Republican Party.
But then again, if you're talking traditional working class whites of union families or such, even so, right? Well, unions certainly aren't as strong as they used to be, but even they leaned Democrat in this election.
Fair enough. So, I mean, I'll support your point that we do need to think about this. But this question of the way in which race and income and class and vote choice are intersecting, there are some things I think that we can conclude. And one is race. The partisanship in race is strongly related. Mm-hmm. Income less so. less so. But there's some strange results when the class and race intersect. Hmm.
Have you seen any exit polls that asked, or even polls before the event that asked the frank question? I suppose particularly to men, can you vote for a woman? I mean, is part of why you are not voting for Mrs. Clinton the fact that she's a woman? In other words, do we know to what extent plain old male chauvinism had anything to do with this? I mean, we certainly talk about Mrs. Clinton's high negative numbers, but they're typically tied to the scandals that have, you know, gone with her. I've seen very little discussion of just the fact that she's a woman and how many American voters would have a problem voting for a woman, plain and simple.
Well, I'll phrase it this way. So first of all, apparently the majority of voters don't have a problem voting for a woman. Right. So let's start there.
Right.
I've not seen a specific question of what you're asking, but what I can say is the exit polls ask the following question. Does Trump's treatment of women bother you? Hmm. And 70% said yes.
Wow. Of all okay. people.
Right. And then, but 29% of those voted for Trump.
Right. So let that go.
You're going to have a hard time finding trustworthy data
right.
on that, right? I mean, very right. few people who have a problem with voting for a woman are going to come out and say that.
And probably some of them don't even know.
I mean, right. So there are going to be some subconscious factors at play as well. And so you might get yes, and answers, I'm comfortable voting for a woman, that are honest, and you might get some that are honest and incorrect, right?
Mm.
I mean,
right,
so they
right.
say they're okay voting for a woman, and they believe it, but in something is working to make them kind of hold different standards and arrive at conclusions that they think are fair but are somehow mediated through this lens of gender.
Right.
We heard a lot before the election, for instance, of, yes, I'm happy to vote for a woman, but I don't want to vote for
that one.
This one.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I do think, just one more quick point, and that is the issues of gender and race, I think, are very present in the way we think and perceive and act when it comes to politics. And one of the aspects of the Trump campaign that I find very fascinating, and I think it connects directly to these questions, is this question of issue of political correctness. And I've talked to so many Trump supporters who feel, right, that political correctness has gone too far, and it's hard not to suspect that this anger or frustration with political correctness is motivated by a sense that they're tired of feeling guilty for their, you know, suspicions about women or their suspicions about racial minorities. So I kind of see this hostility towards the idea of political correctness is in some sense a kind of a proxy for concerns or prejudices or biases.
Interesting. What about the fact that today on NPR, Mara Liasson, in talking about one of the crucial reasons for Mrs. Clinton's defeat, was the fact that she was seen by too many as a status quo candidate in a change year. First of all, to what extent was that an inescapable situation for Mrs. Clinton? That is, how could she paint herself as anything but that in the sense that she has been a part of this process for a long time. I mean, would it have been dishonest to paint her any other way? Versus, was she not as much of a status quo candidate, in fact, as she was perceived by a certain swath of the electorate? I mean, how do we untie that matter?
Well, I think we untie it by adding to it as well.
Hmm.
We've talked before about whether this is a change election or not, and certainly we've said yes to that. Beyond that, though, there's a number of different aspects here. Political science, we usually think about, you know, for how candidates are going to do or parties are going to do, we think about rules, reality, and strategy. Rules for, you know, what you have to abide by and when you're running, the reality of the situation, right, where change would certainly fit in terms of this desire for something different that works for more people, and then whatever the individual strategy of the campaign as such is. I mean, clearly this is a change election. There's a couple things that we could add to that, right? So one is the candidate on the Republican side, Mr. Trump himself, right? Clearly, voters saw him as a flawed candidate. They also saw Secretary Clinton as a flawed candidate, but they saw him as a worse flawed candidate, if you will. But that wasn't a big deal, as it were, for some voters. Secondly, Republicans came home. We've spoken about this before. Would Republicans come home and vote for Donald Trump? It's fair to say in the last 2 weeks of the election that he was viewed as a palatable choice by 90% of Republicans, to that they could now vote for him, and in part that's because political leaders said yes, we'll support him, and it's okay, and we're going to just kind of draw a line underneath some things that he said. We're not going to worry about that right now. Certainly, the GOP made a strong drive for get out the vote efforts as well. Next, I would say that we have to consider that turnout was down. And that had an effect. And you may recall when we were on your show following the Wisconsin primary, one of my concerns that I raised, and I raised it a couple times, and Jerry was much more optimistic than I was, would millennials and others, turn out for Secretary Clinton, particularly those who voted for Bernie Sanders?
Right.
We have to recognize that turnout was indeed down. I mean, if we're looking just at what happened here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin as a whole, turnout was down by a couple hundred thousand people. The vote difference in Milwaukee, there were 52,000. Secretary Clinton got 52,000 fewer votes in Milwaukee than Obama did in 2012. So we have to recognize these kind of aspects as well. There's more to it.
Right.
Yeah, I think Mara Lyson was right to a point, right? I mean, this is clearly an election in which many people felt change was warranted. But we're so polarized that change manifests itself through kind of very partisan kind of responses. And Jeff's point about people coming home to the Republican Party is right. Could Clinton have been something other than an agent of the status quo, so to speak? I mean, she's the first woman to be nominated by a major party. And so in that sense, demographically, she could have been. And yet, like all things, this is really complicated. President Obama's approval numbers are in the mid-50s. There's this sense that, and I think that this motivated the way the Clinton campaign was thinking. It certainly motivated the way I was thinking, that the chances of Clinton winning the election were relatively high in the sense that she did align herself with an extension of the Obama administration and a continuation of the policies that he was pursuing. And Americans, by a decent margin, were saying something about the job, their approval of Mr. Obama that suggested that logic made sense, that it was rational. Many of the same people who say they approve of the job that President Obama is doing or has been doing also feel that the direction of the country is in headed in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. And so, like we've been saying, it's complicated. There are multiple factors running in different directions.
And then you add to that, the appeals that are made by both candidates. Trump on really tapped made an emotional appeal on many different levels, right? Whether you're worried about your job and bringing in immigration and other aspects there, he was able to tap that. Whereas Secretary Clinton had some problems in getting her main message across. It changed a little bit. It finally settled, as such. Although, you know, narratives, they kind of get, if you will, baked in over time, and then you have to really work on that. I think there's also the cross current of kind of some economic and cultural fears, and you know, what does it mean to be quote unquote American these days, right? We've heard a lot prior to the election, even after as well. I get to take my country back. Right. The question is always from whom, and where does that?
You hear people. You hear people saying, "I don't recognize America anymore. Right. I've lost my country." I mean, there are lots of fears out there, and I think it's important that we recognize that a lot of these concerns are valid. Mm-hmm. The emotions that people are having are real, and yet it's also important not to try to cast the environment in which these fears are happening in very simplistic terms, because the environment is very complex, and it's incumbent, I think, on political leadership, on the president-elect, on political leaders, upon people in the media and academia, to honor that complexity and try to help people craft narratives that are healthy and productive, that are honest to the real concerns and problems, but do so in a way that tries to move us forward.
Well, that's no small task, but and of course, how such a thing could be accomplished is in itself a tremendously complicated challenge, and we're going to be watching this, of course, with the great interest, needless to say. In the meantime, I sure appreciate both of you being here on the morning show today to offer your thoughts on what transpired on Tuesday, and even more importantly, what perhaps will happen from this point on, and what some of the most important questions are that we need to ask ourselves about our country and who we are, and where we want this country to go. Jerry Mast and Jeff Roberg from the Political Science Department, thank you sincerely for being part of this and other morning shows through this incredibly interesting and important campaign season. I appreciate this very much.
Thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show from the archives, several different interviews to honor Veterans Day. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host.